Welcome to Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Paff joined by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, a new medical study could pave the way for preventative treatment of breast cancer. Details on the way. The London transit system finds hot dogs to be no joking matter. And on this day in history, the American dollar sign is born. And its origin may surprise you. That's coming up. It's Cool Stuff. Well, we'll open this week with some encouraging medical news pertaining specifically to breast cancer. Let's start by laying out some facts. Everyone has BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes in their system, genes that produce proteins to help repair damaged DNA. So inherently, a good thing, right? Well, each of us has two copies of each gene, one inherited from each parent. The problem with BRCA1 and BRCA2 is this: mutations, which can be inherited and increase the risk of breast and/or ovarian cancer. So, here's the good news. Researchers at the University of Cambridge recently created the world's largest catalog of human breast cells, which revealed early cell changes in healthy carriers of BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations. The study found that the immune cells in the breast tissue of healthy women carrying said gene mutations show signs of malfunction, known as exhaustion, suggesting the immune cells can't clear out damaged breast cells, which can eventually develop into breast cancer. Now, per the study recap, which we'll link to in the show notes, this is the first time exhausted, and I'm using air quotes here, exhausted immune cells have been reported in non-cancerous breast tissues at such scale. Normally, these cells are only found in late-stage tumors. The results raise the possibility of using existing immunotherapy drugs as early intervention to prevent breast cancer from ever developing in carriers of BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations. The researchers have received a Biology to Prevention Award from Cancer Research UK to trial this preventative approach in mice. Now, if effective, this will pave the way to a pilot clinical trial in women carrying said gene mutations. Per Professor Walid Khalid, senior author of the report, quote, "Our results suggest that in carriers of BRCA mutations, the immune system is failing to kill off damaged breast cells, which in turn seem to be working to keep these immune cells at bay. We're very excited about this discovery because it opens up the potential for a preventative treatment other than surgery for carriers of BRCA breast cancer gene mutations," end quote. Khalid went on to note that drugs already exist that can overcome the aforementioned block in immune cell function, but so far, they've only been approved for late-stage disease. No one has really considered using them in a preventative manner. Now, risk-reducing surgery, in which the breasts are removed preventatively, is offered to those at increased risk of breast cancer, but this can be a difficult decision for young women to make and can have a significant effect on body image and sexual relationships. The research utilized samples of healthy breast tissue collected from 55 women across a range of ages. This allowed the researchers to catalog over 800,000 cells, including all types of breast cells. The resulting Human Breast Cell Atlas is now available as a resource for other researchers to use and hopefully add to. Per Austin Reed, a PhD student in the Cambridge Department of Pharmacology and joint first author of the report, quote, "We found that there are multiple breast cell types that change with pregnancy and with age, and it's the combination of these effects and others that drives the overall risk of breast cancer," end quote. He also added, quote, "As we collect more of this type of information from samples around the world, we can learn more about how breast cancer develops and the impact of different risk factors with the aim of improving treatment," end quote. Now, one of the largest challenges in treating breast cancer is that it's not just one disease, but many, resulting from a variety of genetic variations, and these genetic factors interact with other risk factors in complex and often difficult to understand ways. For example, we know the likelihood of breast cancer increases with age, but that risk is greatly mitigated by pregnancy early in life. This new study sought to understand how some risk factors interact by characterizing the different cell types in the human breast under many different physiological states. The researchers then used a technique called single-cell RNA sequencing to characterize the many different breast cell types and states. Almost all cells in the body have the same set of genes, but only a subset of these are switched on in each cell, which ultimately determines the cell's identity and function. Single-cell RNA sequencing reveals which genes are switched on in individual cells. And per Dr. Sarah Pensa, another joint first author of the study, quote, "Breast cancer occurs around the world, but social inequities mean not everyone has access to treatment. Prevention is the most cost-effective approach. It not only tackles inequality, which mostly affects low-income countries, but also improves disease outcome in high-income countries," end quote.
So, Marcus, I am curious. You said earlier in the story that nobody had thought of using the medication in the early stages of cancer. Well, my question is, why not? Out of all the things you could try, why wouldn't you consider using the medication in the early stages of cancer? That seems like a great time to use the medication to prevent it from spreading versus using the medication to stop it when it became a little more deadly. I don't know. Maybe there was something in the medication that made it a little more dangerous in the early stages. But at this point, or at some point, you think they would have said, let's give it a shot and see how it goes.
Yeah, not sure about that one, Reg. The only thing I can think of is perhaps they just didn't believe it would have any kind of efficacy at that stage, be of any value. I don't know. I mean, it's a fair question to ask, but based on what I've read to date and this particular research, didn't really see an explanation as to why it hadn't been tested previously. Nonetheless, it's here now, and like we say about so many stories on this podcast, we'll keep you posted on its progress moving forward.
Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Well, this next story feels, at least to me, like a case of rules or laws extended a bit too far. For one, I wouldn't characterize a hot dog as junk food. That designation is reserved, at least in my mind, for fast food, candy, and other sweets. And while I suppose you could make the case hot dogs are fast food, I think it depends on the type of dog and how it was prepared. Maybe I'm biased, though, because I do tend to love hot dogs. So anyway, you're probably saying, what the bleep are you talking about right now, Marcus? What's with the hot dog chatter? Well, per the Associated Press, English comedian Ed Gamble has been ordered to change and or update a subway station poster, which promotes his new stand-up special because it features the image of a hot dog. And no, not in a dirty or explicit way. It actually violates the Transit Network's ban on junk food advertising. The poster for the show, which is actually titled Hot Diggity Dog, showed Gamble in a ketchup and mustard smeared t-shirt beside a half-eaten hot dog on a plate. To remedy the situation here, Gamble replaced the dog with a cucumber, and the poster was subsequently approved. Now, adding to the humor of the situation, Gamble is diabetic and co-hosts a food podcast called Off Menu. He said he could see the point of the ad rules, which are intended to help curb obesity in children, but also noted, quote, "The new posters promote something way more harmful, the idea that cucumbers pair well with ketchup and mustard," end quote. Of course, there is an upside here. The situation is generally generated a lot of extra publicity for his show, which may cause conspiracy theorists to ask whether he or his marketing team planned for this all along. Don't count me among those people. But he did tell the BBC, quote, "The posters are making way beyond their value now," end quote. Since 2019, Transport for London has banned ads for food that are high in fat, sugar, and salt from the city's subway, trains and stations, buses and bus shelters. It also bans advertisements promoting unhealthy or unrealistic body shapes. Per a representative of the London Transit, quote, "Following a review of the advert, we advised that elements would need to be removed or obscured to ensure it complied with our policy. A revised advert is now running on the network, and we are always happy to work with people to ensure adverts follow our policy," end quote. Last year, a poster for the play Tony and Tina's Wedding, featuring a large wedding cake, also fell outside the rules. TfL ordered the cake to be cut from the ad. So let me just say this. As I noted at the front end of the story, I think this policy goes beyond its intent when you're talking about posters that are really in no way promoting a particular food. Tony and Tina's Wedding once ran for quite a long time here in Las Vegas, where I actually live, and I can't ever remember seeing a poster and thinking, my God, I've got to go eat a wedding cake because of this.
Gotta say, Marcus, I don't get it. I get the fact that they're trying to be a little more healthy for the kids and everyone. What I don't understand, they're not promoting a hot dog. They're not promoting a wedding cake. It is just part of the poster. If they were saying, come on down to whoever's, you know, wedding cake shop, or go to the hot dog vendor at the street, or buy these Oskmeyer hot dogs, okay, ban those posters. But the fact that this was for a comedy tour or special or whatever, and then the other one was for a play, that just doesn't make sense. You're banning something, an image that is just there. I honestly just don't understand. There's so many things you could ban then if you're just going to say, well, this poster has this random picture in it that goes against our beliefs, even though they're not trying to sell that random picture. I don't like it.
But on the other hand, I also have to acknowledge that when you put rigid policies like this in place, it can at times be difficult to determine what does and what does not go beyond the line. What is and what isn't acceptable? It's oftentimes just easier to adhere to a very rigid interpretation, a very literal interpretation of the rules, so that you don't end up having to make determinations about each individual poster that comes out and have a lot of people who are upset and arguing with you because, hey, my poster wasn't intended to promote food at all. So I can sort of see both sides, but man, there's just not a lot of common sense seemingly being used here. If you disagree, as we always say, hit us up, coolstuffcommute@gmail.com.
Taking a look at this day in history, on April 1st, 1778, that dollar symbol, you know, the one that's on your four key in the keyboard, well, that was created. It actually started with the American Revolution and the Spanish pesos. Oliver Pollock, a prominent Irish businessman in colonial America, is often credited with popularizing the use of the dollar symbol. He was born in Ireland in 1737 and later immigrated to the American colonies. He settled in Philadelphia, where he initially worked as a merchant and trader. Pollock quickly established himself as a shrewd businessman with a keen understanding of commerce and finance. Then in the early 1770s, Pollock relocated to New Orleans, then under Spanish control. In New Orleans, Pollock engaged in various business ventures, including trading goods and commodities with the Spanish and American settlers in the region. However, not all of his business ventures were successful. In fact, he had to file bankruptcy at one point, but he didn't quit and was eventually a very successful businessman. With the wealth that he had earned, he felt it was his duty to help procure supplies and munitions for the Continental Army. Pollock's efforts were instrumental in sustaining the American war effort, particularly in the southern colonies. He said it was his duty as an Irishman to help the Americans against England. You know, a little bit of tensions there between Ireland and England at that time, especially. He donated 30,000 pesos to the cause, which would be the equivalent of over $1 billion today. However, what does this all have to do with that dollar symbol? Well, as Pollock conducted his business dealings in New Orleans, he developed a shorthand symbol to denote the Spanish peso, a widely used currency in the region. The symbol that he devised was made from combining the S and P, his shorthand for the Spanish peso, and it resembled the modern dollar sign. The first time he used this symbol was on April 1st, 1778. Pollock's use of the symbol in his financial records and correspondence helped popularize its adoption among merchants and traders in the area. The dollar sign's association with commerce and currency has endured over the centuries, becoming an iconic symbol of monetary value worldwide. By the way, Oliver Pollock passed away in New Orleans in 1823, leaving behind a legacy as a pioneering entrepreneur and patriot.
Fascinating, Reg. Honestly, I never had any idea where the currency symbol for a dollar came from. Honestly, I don't think I'd ever even given it a thought, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about how many things were derived from that period of history. And then obviously just looking at it and thinking about a shorthand notation for S and P with the S and a line through it. Makes all the sense in the world. Next week, I expect you to explain to me where the pound sign, aka the hashtag, came from, because that one still perplexes me too.
That'll do it for another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. You can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. I'm Reggie Rizzu. He's Marcus Paff. Don't forget to leave that review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.